Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Parasite, a patron-exclusive review chosen by Justin Ramsey. Hosted by Jacob, Arnie, and Stuart. This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language. Listener discretion is advised. We hope you enjoy the show.
Today, we're discussing Parasite, starring Song Kang-ho, Lee Sun-kwan, Cho Yeo-jeong, directed by Bong Joon-ho. This is Arnie, the parasitic co-host of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is the host that's so metaphorical, Jacob.
Welcome back, patrons, to a review of a Oscar-winning film that we sort of talked about once before. This was the year we did our live Oscar show.
Yep, I remember it well. 2020 was the year. I actually kind of find it annoying when they say that the winner is 2020 when the movies all came out in 2019. But that's what ends up happening. It's the 2020 Oscars for the 2019 movies. And Parasite shook it up. I actually had it pegged for winning, but a lot of people were surprised that a Korean film could take Best Picture.
Yeah, I was rooting for this one too.
Yeah, I honestly don't normally make it a point to watch all Best Picture nominees, but that year, because we did the live show, I did. This was absolutely my favorite of all the ones we watched, but it kind of feels like we have a Best Foreign Film Academy Award for a reason, so I never thought this actually could win Best Picture.
I figured it would get Best Foreign Picture, but like, why does a movie have to be in English to be the best movie?
The real funny thing would be if this won Best Picture, but not Best Foreign Film, but it did take both of those.
Well, you know, that could happen too, because there are different rules about who can vote. I mean, the thing to remember is Best Picture is voted on by everyone. Certain people can vote for other categories, and they have strong stipulations. So in theory, yes, a different voting block could have gotten pegged to vote for foreign film and wound up with something else that year. But yeah, I feel like Parasite hit all the marks. It was Oscar responding to Oscar So White and proving that it could look beyond what gets made in Hollywood itself, but it also, I think, spoke to class issues that are with us right now, that this movie felt incredibly contemporary, even though it is about Korea at a certain time and place. The struggles that these families are going through economically to survive feel totally relevant to America here and now, my life.
Too true. And I mean, we're going to talk about it, but it was a combination of drama, suspense, and comedy in this film that really made me take to it among the other films. So I was really excited when Justin Ramsey picked this film for us to review. And Justin, thank you for that. He says this was his favorite movie of 2019. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to be lame and say Endgame and then this. He thinks that this has some interesting ideas about class, and then he also thinks it works well as a thriller. But he paid us a big compliment, and I was really happy to read this. He likes hearing us talk foreign films. We don't do that often, but High Tension and Battle Royale, High Tension was another patron pick, are some of his favorite episodes. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, we don't do enough in my book. I watch a lot of foreign films. I'd say it's probably at least 30% of what I watch, or used to, before I did a podcast that made me watch so much comic book stuff.
And I'll say, I think Korean films have kind of overtaken my foreign film watching. Like, I used to watch a ton of Japanese stuff, but maybe over the last 12, 13 years, I've watched a lot of Korean films from this director, from other directors, and they definitely have a flavor, at least the ones that get noticed in the West. I don't watch a lot of dramas of just people sitting around talking in Korean, but yeah, the ones that are outrageous enough to get noticed here, I have checked out quite a few.
Well, I think everyone got on the Squid Game train. Like, that felt like a hit that was bigger than anything. And the biggest TV show of last year.
Oh, so good, too.
Yeah, my daughters wanted to watch Parasite because they got so into Squid Game.
And that feels, I mean, again, there's a thematic tie in class and violence that both of those share. But I feel like the trend has been brewing for a while. It's funny how certain areas of the world will become hot spots for cinema. And Korea, I think, started with Chan-Woo Park. I do feel like Old Boy sort of put it on the map, his violence, vengeance trilogy. He's made some other cool movies, too. I'm a fan of Thirst. It was a sort of elegant take on the vampire.
Handmaiden's messed up. I've seen that one.
Yeah, I like his stuff. He does feel like the godfather of all that we're talking about now, but in the last couple years, Korean cinema is big. Train to Busan was a zombie movie that got big. Burning, The Wailing, I Saw the Devil. They're all serial killer / horror genre efforts, but with subtle drama mixed in. I do think that there's something, I wish we could do a whole retrospective, because I do feel like Korea is happening right now.
Well, we'll put the Vengeance trilogy on the calendar then, because I'd love to do that.
And I do feel like Bong Joon-ho, the director of Parasite, like I've seen most of his films going back to Mother and Memory of a Murder, like definitely dealing with those heavy topics. But he's also done Snowpiercer, which was a huge hit, got a TV show. A little overrated in my book, but he does a lot with class and all of his films. The Host, which is a monster film. You watch that and Parasite, like there's definitely similar themes going on.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you. I saw a few Bong Joon-ho movies, and I always thought that he was kind of like a Guillermo del Toro. Yeah, he's got pretensions, but mostly he's about the monster mash. Mostly he just wants to do outrageous things and have fun. And like this movie surprised me. It surprised me that he was capable of going to this level, because I thought of him working on a more superficial comic book kind of Snowpiercer, very similar movie, but not the same impact. I'm just going to leave it at that.
And you look at the film that came out before this one, which I think was a Netflix exclusive, Okja, which I think was his attempt at a kid's film. But imagine E.T. if like they autopsied E.T. Like,
oof, don't look at that one. I hated that movie. I didn't like it at all.
The tone is wild in that one. It swings all over the place. And so it was interesting to see Parasite, because I agree with you, Stuart. Like, this feels like a maturity of the director. Like, he had all these topics, and he felt like he wanted a lot more humor and monsters and that kind of thing. This one felt like almost a totally different director.
I agree. I wasn't prepared. I went in, I saw it in theaters before it was nominated or anything. I just knew it was his new movie, and I was in Chicago. God knows it wouldn't be playing in Springfield. I was like, oh, let me check this one out, and was blown away. I was like, wow, this is really, I can see why it won the Palme d'Or. It had already come to America on the wings of, wow, it won the Cannes Film Festival. That's probably as big as a movie like this is ever going to get. But yeah, it just kept breaking box office records, made $50 million here in the U.S. and $210 million internationally, big box office hit. HBO optioned it for a TV series. I wonder if that's still happening. And then, yeah, Oscars roll around and it takes not only Best Picture, but Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Foreign Film. Like, this movie cleaned up.
Well, let's get into it. Stuart, why don't you give us the plot?
Well, Parasite profiles three Korean families living in three distinct economic brackets. The poorest of the lot are the Kims, a family of four who have been reduced to folding pizza boxes for chump change in a basement apartment crawling with stink bugs. Their fortunes brighten when the son is asked by a university friend to take over tutoring the daughter of the Parks, the rich family of this story. There's just one catch. The Parks are all about image. The Kim son will need to pass himself off as a prestigious university student with the Americanized name of Kevin in order to land the job. But fortunately, the Kim daughter is a master forgerer, and Madam Park and her high school daughter, Dae-hae, are gullible, lonely women who can be seduced into hiring this imposter. And this lays the groundwork for the rest of the Kim clan to be hired on with the Park family under false pretenses. The sister reinvents herself as art therapist Jessica, and begins working with the Park's hyperactive boy, Desong. Jessica then gets the Park chauffeur fired so that her dad can take over driving duties for patrician Nathan Park, a tech company CEO. And eventually, housemaid Moon Guak-gok is sent packing, which is no small feat to engineer because she's been working in this high-tech household ever since it was first built by the previous owner. And this is where we learn the third family of the story, the Gooks, have also been living off the overabundance of the Park family. 4 years ago, Moon Guak-gook's husband got in trouble with loan sharks and needed a place to hide. She stashed him in a secret panic room without the rich family even knowing that this space existed. Moon Gwak has come back to the park residence while the rich family is off camping to strike a deal with the new maid, Chung Sook, and to let her husband stay underground there. But when she realizes this big con that the entire Kim family has pulled on the parks, she threatens to expose their real identities and maybe even reclaim her old job. Climactic torrential rains ruin everything for all three families. First, it brings the Parks home early from camping, and now they want to throw a birthday party impromptu on the lawn for Daesung. Meanwhile, the Kim basement home has completely flooded, and all their worldly possessions are destroyed, save a good luck rock. And finally, Moon Gwak Gook was kicked down the stairs in the panic of their return, and now she's got a concussion and dies, leaving her husband to emerge from his hiding space during the birthday party on a murderous spree. He kills the Kim daughter, he clobbers the Kim son with the magic rock, and before it's all over, he is killed by the Kim mother with shish kebab, of all things. And Mr. Kim also loses his temper and stabs Mr. Park dead in the chaos, ironically then needing to seek refuge in the same panic room that the Gook husband had just vacated. This leaves the Kim son, formerly known as Kevin, to begin recovering from his head injury and concocting get-rich-quick schemes that might finally allow him to buy this beautiful residence that has become his father's new jail cell and free Mr. Kim from a purposeless life in the basement as credits roll. So it's worth asking at the start of this. I knew someone that saw this movie. It always brings out interesting reactions, but she came from a wealthier background. It was interesting to see her take. And her reaction after she saw it was, this just goes to show you shouldn't be nice to the help.
She took away that poor people are the parasite?
That was the takeaway. They're going to get you. They're going to stab you with shish kebab. You can't be kind. Do not let the help into your life, was her takeaway. And I wonder, with the title called Parasite, aren't they kind of conveying that everything that we're going to see is parasitic, disgusting behavior, that we should hate these upwardly mobile poor people for trying to take what the rich have?
I see it as ironic after I saw the film. Yeah, you think that parasite, okay, this is poor people leeching off the rich. You think about, you know, those who get angry about those on welfare and downtrodden. But if you, like, watch this, there's a lot of stuff about class, like poor keeping down the poor. I feel like that's a big part of this. It's not just rich and poor. It's all problems with class.
Right, and the case could probably be made that the rich people are just as needy and dependent on the poor people as it goes in both directions.
Yeah, they can't cook their own meals. Like, we see how Mrs. Park is. Not a great housekeeper. She needs a maid.
It is a provocative title, though, and I do think maybe that's the point, that it gets people shooken up that, yeah, something here is going to be leeching off another.
Yeah, I never had a whole lot of sympathy for the rich people, but on the second watching, I definitely felt much more like you should be looking askance at all the people pulling off the con jobs. But because of how the movie starts off and who we're introduced to first, they're really playing us to root for the underprivileged.
Yeah, I think we like the Kims, or at least that's what they're hoping for. It works for me. We see that they're in this first shot of the movie. I mean, usually the first shots of a movie should tell you a lot of information. And we just see this basement apartment view of trash. Eventually, we'll see somebody peeing outside the window and socks hanging off light fixtures. It is a depressing worldview that they have here on the bottom that mirrors their economic status. The Kims are barely scraping by.
They're literally an underclass living underground in this half basement. And one of the amazing production things, like, it should have gotten an Oscar for production design.
Totally.
Because none of this is real. This basement apartment is a set. This whole alleyway is a set.
What?
The house, when we get to the parks, the exterior, it's only a one-story house that they CGI'd a second story on, but all the interiors are all a set.
Oh, wow.
I had no idea of that. I mean, I figured some of it was, but I really did think that a lot of this was shot in real locations.
Yeah, there's a few real locations like that auditorium. If you've seen The Host, it's the same auditorium that the director used for that film. But yeah, a lot of stuff that's just subtle CGI stuff that you would never notice watching this.
And I mean, location is a character here. The way that these people are forced to live, how it defines them. The fact that we see the characters are introduced trying to find cell signal and like curling up against a raised toilet. I've never seen this kind of setup, but like curled up with the toilet trying to get a cell signal so that they can get a job at a pizzeria folding boxes. It tells you a lot of information fast.
And one, and Stuart, maybe you have better insight into this. I figure for a big action, sci-fi, CGI-heavy movie, of course you're going to have storyboards and animatics to figure out all the action. Like, My Dinner with Andre or Room with a View, do you usually have storyboards? Like, I don't think of that with dramas, but Bong Joon-ho, like, he did the storyboards himself, like, very meticulous. They actually released it as a graphic novel because, like, he planned every shot in this. Nothing is by accident. Everything is designed and shot for a reason here.
I think the intentionality of everything, you feel when the camera moves, it's telling you something. Again, just the way that we're just so low here, looking out at the world, it just... Cinematography is great in this film.
I wish I could more relate to the economic situation of South Korea to really get this. I mean, I can put forth that this is for people who are unemployed, but the fact that they're talking about PhDs or getting jobs as janitors and things like that is something I've never experienced. And so to really relate to them, I hate to say this, but if this were an American movie and you have all four people unemployed, it would be very hard to make it seem like they're hardworking and want to work. You know, it would be much more common to try to say they just didn't want work because if they couldn't find anything for when you're dealing with four people. So I understand that to be a cultural difference.
I don't know that I feel like this is about Korea. I feel like there, I know lots of people that are emerging from university and working low wage jobs. I mean, we're in an interesting time now where there's a lot of openings for jobs, but again, people are being asked to work below their education level. I think that's a pretty common thing.
Yes, but they're not being asked to fold pizza boxes, which is a job I did have, but it was when I was in college and you also delivered the pizzas. It's not hard to fold those boxes. I don't know why they couldn't get it right.
It's the dad.
Yeah.
He gets everything wrong.
But I do feel like this is hustle culture. Like now, like a lot of young people, they don't have a regular 9-to-5 job. They're doing Uber or these food delivery services. And I feel like this is a family that is stuck at that level. Like they can't get that normal work. So they're hustling. They could fold pizza boxes. They could do this and that. Like, but they just can't get good paying employment.
And that's everywhere. I mean, McDonald's used to be a job that teenagers worked while they're in high school, and now it's considered career level for certain people. And that just sucks. That just shows the stagnation. I think certainly you can look at certain periods of time in America in the last 20 years, right after the housing crisis, particularly, where there people were in these desperate straits. Maybe right this second, we're seeing a trend of people choosing not to go back to their jobs. It's an interesting moment. But 2019, this felt believable to me. I've lived this way. I mean, I'll just put it bluntly. I have had roommates and I've lived this way. I have made corn sandwiches. Like, I have had to scrape by. I know exactly what it is.
I have too, but that's called our 20s.
I've noticed in Asian cinema, again, usually I watch samurai films or some crazy Korean thing based off a graphic novel. But when you do get to the dramas, I feel like they're more and more willing to explore, again, the poor in their country. And it's just a different look. It's something I don't think of because I'm like, oh, you have samurais and they're just slashing people and getting paid for it. But no, there are homeless people in Japan and there's films about that. And same with Korea. So it's just something I don't think we see, especially as Westerners. None of us are up on Korean politics, but that is reality there just as it is here.
Well, let's ask the question, are they parasites? Are they just con artists that don't want to work? That isn't my impression. We don't really know.
No.
They're hustling hard for money.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that they are really hardworking people. These people aren't in their situation because they don't want to work or even undereducated.
And again, the choice of do we leave the window open and thus fumigate all the stink bugs that are in our loaf of bread that we're trying to eat? Or yeah, do we close it and protect ourselves from the poisonous fumes?
Yeah, the funny thing with that is when I first saw this trailer, because my wife and I had seen Okja and The Host, like my wife's like, oh, they're going to turn into cockroaches in this film. I think like a different Bong Joon-ho, like that would have been his parasite.
Agreed. That could have been exactly where the old Bong Joon would go. But again, this movie surprised me. I didn't know a lot about it going in, but I think I did know that they were going to take advantage of a rich family. And that opportunity comes... yeah, after this pizza generation box folding fiasco. Again, you can look at the dad. He's the guilty one. He was the one trying to fold the boxes while the cloud of smoke was...
trying to watch that video through the fog, yeah.
he does seem to be, of the group, the one who's going to be the most problematic.
Agreed. And the one thing I wish this movie could articulate, are there cutscenes? I didn't watch this on DVD. I streamed it on Hulu. But I'd be curious to know if there is some kind of Criterion longer cut or something that might elaborate on what has happened to the dad in particular.
There is not a longer cut. There's a black and white cut for some reason. Like, if you're dying to watch this in black and white.
Can you help me understand that? I don't know why it would be a black and white cut.
I don't know. I didn't understand it. Like, and listening to a lot of the extras, because English isn't their first language, sometimes you don't really get explanations. They try to get something out, but it's not very understandable.
Okay. So there is no cutscene that anyone knows about that would explain what the dad's plan is. Because we will have him defined later as someone that is sitting in a basement, but scheming to get out. He has ambition. And that's not really clear here in that opening, but it is said later.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up that he has a plan, because I feel like he goes against that later on. I mean, we'll get there. But that's his facade, is you gotta have a plan to get out of this, and the son's gonna buy into that philosophy. He's always gonna have a plan throughout this film, but the dad's gonna give up on that at some point.
I'm not sure that he even does have a plan, but no. Maybe he likes to think that he does. He certainly doesn't like to think that he's trapped in this basement level forever. Who would? Nobody would want to say, this is where I'm comfortable living the rest of my life.
And there's some interesting things, like if you notice, the mom, she has a medal. I don't know if she went to the Olympics, but she's a hammer thrower, if you're familiar with that track and field sport. Like, we'll get a glimpse of that. Like, they had achieved something at some point, if you look at the backgrounds.
Yeah, I wanted more, and I wondered if there was more on the cutting room floor.
I agree, but they do such a good job of selling their current situation that I don't think I need it.
Bong Joon-ho talked about some of his influences, and one, you know, it made total sense. Have you seen Kurosawa's High and Low, which is about an industrialist that's rich and lives high up above the city, and someone poor down below kidnaps his son, and it's this crime thriller. But the other influence that he called out was so bizarre. He said Mad Max Fury Road was a huge influence on this film, just because it is a film that just goes. It's not going to give you that background. You're just going to have to pick it up, and it just moves forward the whole time. And he was so impressed with that style of storytelling, like he wanted to bring it into this film.
That's awesome.
I can understand from a dark energy place that this movie has something in common with Fury Road. But I feel like a lot of things are justified here. One thing I really want to call out, not only am I glad that this won Best Picture, but yeah, the script is so well calibrated. It's so well calculated into telling the reasons why the story is going to unfold the way that it does. I feel like you could have empathy and contempt for every single person we're going to meet because of the way it's written.
The Kim's son, who will end up going by Kevin, is the most sympathetic across the board. He, to me, comes off as the one who kind of got in the middle of a bad situation. He's got this friend, Min, who is basically telling him, I want to help your family. I'm bringing you this big stone, and this stone is supposed to hopefully help bring wealth as a totem or a good luck item. And then says, I want you to take this tutoring job, and says, forge papers. I don't get the impression that the Kim family were grifters until the moment this external force, who is a much better off university student able to pay to go overseas, comes in and says, lie.
Oh no, Ki-jung or Jessica, the daughter, like, she is a grifter. Like, she's got those Photoshop skills. Like, she is ready to go. Again, when I watch this with my girls, because they were so high on Squid Game, like, one of my daughters, like, this was her favorite character. But you're saying that this friend is trying to help out Kevin. He doesn't want anyone to sleep with the girl he likes. That's how it comes off to me. It's very selfish.
Yeah, and further thought on that, just something that I had seen this movie 3 times. In my second viewing, it occurred to me, Kevin might be gay, right? Like, part of the reason why the friend comes to him and says, I know you aren't going to be like the frat guys that would take over this job and try to sleep with the girl that I want to sleep with, is that in some way, I know that you won't go there.
My reading was, it's because he's poor and just he doesn't have the confidence to maybe go after this girl. I didn't read that other subtext there.
I didn't read it as gay, and especially since he does end up going for the girl.
Well, that's what makes that even more like, oh, you're not going after her because you like her. You're going after her so you can marry into her money. I don't know. It could be a translation thing, but at a certain point, he later describes a guy as having a good physique and all that. It's there. I definitely feel like it's an interesting way to look look at that character in a less sympathetic way. I got to say, again, if you think that he's homosexual and he's just preying upon flirting with these women, knowing that he has no interest in them, it does make him a little bit more of a cat.
It does. I didn't get that reading. What I took this as is Min saying, "You're my real friend." Min wouldn't bring that stone if he just was worried about somebody sleeping with the girlfriend. I think Min is coming from a place of kindness.
No, I definitely feel like that's cultural. Like, you bring a present for the family, and he says, "I'm so excited to see your folks again." But really, what's he doing? He's flirting with the sister. So, like, he's just kind of a ladies' man. It was a way of coming back in and seeing if the sister was still available. And yeah, so maybe this guy, for whatever reason, I don't think he's threatening. He can step in and be the placeholder until I can come back and date this girl that I'm tutoring that's in high school.
Again, I took that as, I feel like this is a real friend because it's not a university competitor, and that's why he trusts Kevin.
I don't think there's a lot of, like, genuine empathy and love in this story. It's great that you're bringing that in there, but I definitely feel like in well-calibrated satires, everyone has very selfish aims, and I didn't see this character in any way benevolent.
I see only him as the benevolent one, and then he leaves having started the downfall of the Kim family morality.
No, they were already pretty far down, but yes, it gives them an opportunity to go in a new direction. They were trying to get a job at Pizza Generation, but now they can actually, yeah, all they got to do is forge some documents and be convincingly good at English. And I take it to mean that the reason why Min and Kevin are even friends is because at one point they were in university together, and probably Kevin couldn't afford to stay in the game.
I took it as high school friends because it said Kevin took the entrance exams 4 times. So either he couldn't afford to go once he passed them, or he never passed them.
That's where I was at too.
Yeah, but this guy knows he's smart enough to do the job. He has the skills. So yeah, just print out some documentation. The sister's good at forging. I love the fact that the dad's so proud of it too. He's like, "Oh, my daughter, look at these documents. And my son, the forger." It's just a funny way of seeing this family.
I mean, she can make some real money if she practices that forgery. Do some passports, driver's license.
The world is their oyster, but they're going to start here with the Parks. And this is where we see a very unassuming house immediately turn into some beautiful hideaway. It's almost a theme of this movie that what starts out looking ordinary, like has all of these dimensions, just looks like concrete. And then it lets them in and there's like topiary garden.
You think that house looks ordinary with all of its angles and levels and everything? To me, that looks like a very bougie house.
On the outside.
Yeah, I'm saying from the outside.
You can't see it. When he is standing there ringing the bell, it is a staircase to a cement block. You cannot tell that it looks cool.
No, but when you start seeing the exterior from the backyard and things.
Well, yeah, once you're inside, that's all that I'm saying. All I'm trying to say is from the street level, this wouldn't look like any, you would never even notice it. But once he's led inside, wow, like look at the opportunity I've been given.
And the interesting thing, when they were designing this, they said that they put up artwork in this house, that they wouldn't even say what the price was. It was so expensive. And when it came to decorating the basement that the Kims live in, like they would just find free trash, like sitting around to decorate it. Like they really did spend a lot of money to make this place look as beautiful as it looks. Like, I want to live in this house, even though it doesn't exist. It's all sets.
And again, a theme that again reoccurs, mistaken identities. We have Kevin walking in here and mistaking the housemaid for the madam. And like, you know, we'll find out that this woman, again, you might not notice her. She's only the maid after all, but she's been here the whole time. She knew the original architect, Namgoon, and this will all play out as very important, even though in this moment she feels superfluous.
It seemed shocking to me that if the architect liked her so much, he wouldn't take her with him, but instead he just strongly suggests to the new homeowners. Did the architect know about her husband in the basement? I would think not.
He's only been there 4 years, so this is, I'm guessing, after the architect.
Okay.
What gets ultimately said about the architect is that he built this panic room space to protect himself from either an attack from North Korea, which, I guess I get that, or from creditors. So he probably had some money problems of his own and probably disappeared in the middle of the night. He didn't take her with him because he was disappearing on the lam.
Maybe it's a translation thing. My subtitle said a lot of Korean houses have these bunkers to hide from creditors or in case North Korea bombs. So I didn't take it as this guy was on the lam. And if you're running from creditors, you don't stick around to tell the new homeowners, oh, hire my maid.
I don't know that he did actually say that. We don't know how she got the job. Again, probably a little deception.
I thought it was interesting, though, that it was called out for creditors, because we'll find out that her husband's down there because of creditors.
Loan sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The interesting dynamic, and again, you're looking at these relationships. Are the poor playing the rich? Are the rich exploiting the poor? When we see this maid, like, she's going to get Mrs. Park, and she's drunk, like, passed out outside at a table, and she's got to, like, clap and wake her up and tell her this new tutor's there. Like, when I'm watching this the first time, I'm like, okay, is she actually running this family? She's drugging them? Like, I'm trying to figure out what these relationships are. But I think it's just, like, bored rich housewife.
I took it as maybe she was on tranquilizers. Again, bored rich housewife, probably on some kind of pill.
Yeah, I don't know how common this is, but this woman feels pained in her loneliness. And part of the reason why Kevin is able to get in here is, yeah, the forgery was good, but he's also just seductive. He's flirting with her. He's flirting with the daughter. He'll end up grabbing her hand and feeling her pulse. And just the way that he's playing into them, like, plays into their loneliness. That, yeah, they're just sitting around waiting around, and we will rarely see the madam have an interaction with her husband. She's always kind of talking to the housemaid or to her children. She rarely engages with the man that she supposedly loves.
Yeah, and this is a trait we saw of Kevin's earlier. Like, he is the one that could talk his way into things. When Pizza Generation shows up and they're unhappy with the boxes, it is Kevin that's able to, like, negotiate some kind of payment.
By flirting. Yeah, he was the one that was like, why don't you kick your brother out and I can be your co-driver?
And I found it funny, though, because Mrs. Park says she doesn't care about documents. She doesn't hardly look at these well-forged papers.
Well, again, that is the defining trait, is that you can fool a lot of people. I think there are a lot of stories right now of people that have gotten away with a lot of cons by just looking the part, right? Like, you don't have to actually know the thing. You can just wear the right suit. You can have the right documents. You can whisper the right names. The reference gets you the job, not your actual abilities.
It's all about confidence, Arnie. You know what I'm talking about. At Comic-Con, like, there's places you're not allowed to go, but if you just walk in like you're supposed to be there, a lot of times they'll just let you in.
I have been in the worst places that way. I was in the loading docks thinking I was taking a shortcut and got completely lost, but because I walked with an air of I knew what I was doing, it's fake it till you make it, right? I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and I do think one of the more subtle ideas here, but the fact that he has an American name and goes by that is what's so impressive. This is a family that is trying to, like, grab onto that. Like, they'll make a big deal about American Indians and give to their son a teepee and import actual Indian arrows from America, whatever the hell that means. I mean, they're suction cup arrows.
Come on, it's obvious. I mean, a people that were colonized and thrown out of their land, like, that's what Bong Joon-ho was going for, like, the actual history of how we treated Indians.
Oh, yeah, that's the metaphor. Yeah, obviously. But, I mean, for these people, they're too stupid to realize that that's the story of the American Indian. They think that it legitimizes their life, that they have authentic Indian arrows.
Yeah, they're more American because of it.
Yes, and thus higher class. And so, yes, bringing up Dae-sung, the... I don't know. How old is he? It's his birthday soon. I don't know if they ever said.
In first grade is when he saw the ghost, and this is 4 or 5 years after that.
So 9, 10?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, around that.
He's got some emotional problems, but they're trying to say that, like, he's just a temperamental artist. And they're hanging up his doodles on the wall, and they basically need an art teacher from America to rein in his genius. Enter Jessica.
And this is where Kevin takes his first step beyond doing what Min told him. This is where he sees an opportunity of, oh my God, I fooled her so easily. I could bring in my sister here. I'll just start saying that this kid needs an art teacher.
And again, this is Jessica, like, it just comes to her naturally, like, conning. She's got all the great cons. Like, she's the one that could forge and all of this. So she, yeah, walks in here and just, I love the way that she's dismissive. She's like, I'm not going to ask for this job. I'm going to be like, if I decide to take this job, you're going to need to leave and you're going to need to do this. And I need to know all about his psychological history and what happened in first grade. Like, she knows how to intimidate.
How did she know about first grade, or was that just a damn lucky guess?
No, obviously she got some kind of information out of the kid. Those are the cutscenes I want. Like, is she threatening this kid? He is so calm around her and behaved. And, like, I don't know what she's telling him, but she's getting information out of him.
I agree. Because the mom is not allowed to watch, she even tries to send the housemaid in there to spy. But, like, we will never know what she says. But the kid goes from shooting bows and arrows and running around the house like a maniac to bowing and being quiet. And, yeah, has probably told her a lot about ghosts and things that have happened to him.
Yeah, he probably just needed someone to pay attention to him, because mm-hmm. that mom doesn't seem like she's paying attention to those kids.
Good point. Exactly.
But I do love, like, she freaks that mom out. Oh, this is the schizophrenia area of the drawing. And you can see it's in his old drawing. I'm like, she had to have observed that and, like, had him do that again. Like, I want to see more scenes with Jessica and the son doing art lessons.
Well, what she said was she Googled art therapy and then just made up the rest. And so I wondered if the schizophrenia area, the fact that it was on that other painting, was just like, yes, of course it is. And she had no idea.
Yeah, the point is that these people are very insecure. They're superficial and they're insecure. It's a very bad combination. So once they finally allow trust in, they might have very imperious views about who's worth listening to. But once you're in the club, they'll give you the keys. And so now Jessica is totally on board and she can start making a plot about bringing on mom and dad as well.
It's day one, right? Jessica's there day one that she decides to take off her panties and leave them in the car.
Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. She's already plotting.
You'd think, I mean, maybe it's me, you'd think you'd, like, give it a month or something so you aren't the brand new person, but maybe they're just so hard up they can't afford to wait.
I think it's part of it. And then how long is this going to last? You got to strike while the iron's hot. Like, it feels like a short-term scheme, right? Like, this probably, you know, is just going to last a little bit longer than the pizza boxes.
And I think you get some insight into how the rich think about their help, or at least how Mr. Park does, because they find this underwear and, like, where he goes is not where I would assume. Like, oh, he must be on drugs, because how could you forget panties? Like, you could only do that if you're high.
And does he enjoy ejaculating on the seat where I sit?
Yeah, this is so great, because to them, it allows them to feel superior. Oh, he took my beautiful Mercedes-Benz and then seduced women and did it in the car, like in my back seat. And all of this is a way of feeling like scumbag. We have to get rid of him. But two things. One, we can't get rid of him for that reason. I'm too cowardly to call him out for the reasons I want him gone. And two, this will later be a sex fantasy with his wife.
And this is where he brings up this theme of crossing the line. The poor people cannot cross that line. The biggest sin was that this driver got into his seat to have sex. If you would have had sex in the driver's seat, like, he might have been okay with it, but he crossed the line.
He says that, but I'm like, have you ever tried having sex in the driver's seat? The back seat's far more comfortable.
Yes.
No, these people are not very creative with sex. Again, I don't know that this couple is having sex. Like, they feel very distant. The moments that we will have with them as a couple look strained. And yes, we'll get there when we get there. But I always thought, every time I watch this movie, I always think we're going to find out about Nathan's mistress. But he doesn't seem to have one. He just is in a marriage of, I presume, convenience. He got married to this woman not because he loved her, but because it was the right status symbol.
I feel like, even though we don't see it, there's enough implied about there being a mistress. First of all, he's not around very much. And second of all, once the dad gets in there as a driver, he's like, well, you love her. And he's like, let's call it love. You know, there's so much implied there that I feel I can read between those lines.
Well, that doesn't mean mistress. That just means I married someone for reasons other than love. Like, that just means she probably had the money or she had the status. Like, he now runs a tech company, it seems like. We only get one moment of him at work.
Another brick is the company, because Bong Joon-ho is a big Pink Floyd fan.
Oh, okay. All right. Didn't get the reference, but there you go. Yeah, my sense is that maybe she supplied the seed money that allowed that company to grow. He represents, like, New Korea, and now they've moved into this old, fancy old house and tried to make it their own and junked it all up.
Yeah, we never see Mr. Park ask Mr. Kim to take him to some seedy hotel or anything. He wants to get braised ribs. Like, that's what he wants that his wife can't provide.
Again, he seems so unsatisfied with her on all levels. He just isn't around her. Whether or not he loves anyone or anything, the dads remain, both of them, both Park and Kim, are sort of ciphers. And you're right, maybe if I knew more about Korean society, they would seem like stereotypes. But I have a lot of curiosities that the movie chooses to not answer.
See, and I kind of go with them as stereotypes of rich businessman, unaffected housewife. I feel like I've seen that a lot.
And I do want to call out, because we're going through the plot, but like the humor of this film, like, it's a funny film. Like, when Mr. Kim, they go to the BMW dealership so you can learn how to actually drive that kind of car and what all the buttons do. Like,
Mercedes, they're asked, do you drive a Benz?
Yeah, there's a lot of humor throughout this film that I really appreciate.
Oh, this first half hour to hour is very funny. It's shocking the turns this movie will take, because this could be seen as a laugh-out-loud satire for so much of this, the way that the Kim family just integrates themselves and ingratiates, and the stereotypes of the rich people, how they're able to just take over so easily.
Yeah, I think that humor really kicks in when they have to get rid of that maid so the mom could start working there too. And they find out about that peach allergy.
Each job that they find, it becomes a little bit crueler, right? Like, no one really got hurt when Kevin came aboard other than, yeah, now he's sort of kissing during the lessons. And again, is that even because he wants to, or because he has ideas about marrying into this family for social climbing reasons? But then Jessica, yeah, now she's like prying into the psychology of a child. And yeah, the dad got someone fired. An innocent man, June, ended up on the street because they wanted a job more and they feel they're more entitled.
Later on, there will be a moment of remorse and reflection of like, do you feel June is doing okay? And I think it's the daughter who says, oh, forget him. We needed it more.
Right. That's the justification that anyone makes at any station of the social ladder climbing, right? It's like, oh, I deserve this. I had the ambition to go for it. These are the things you tell yourself when you step on people on your way to where you go. But yes, taking someone that is allergic to fruit and torturing them with it, this could actually kill Moon Gwak.
Yeah, she doesn't seem to care so much. I mean, they do a very little bit. It's funny to watch them shave the peach fuzz with a razor just to get such a little bit and then put it on her neck. But then the father follows her to the hospital. The tuberculosis, that's a hard way to get somebody fired. I wouldn't think you could keep that fake up for long.
It takes two to tango, right? So yes, it takes the poor people the gumption to stick it to this poor housemaid that's given her whole life to this house. But then that the rich people are like, we can get another maid. It's no problem. Like, one little thing. No sympathy. There's no empathy for that this woman is sick. It's entirely viewed as get this diseased, infected, parasitic thing out of our lives.
And it's very American Psycho when they go to pick that new maid. They like that business card. It's a very nice business card for the help. And so that's why they hire her.
Again, that was the daughter. Like, she's got all the great scams. She's the one that has, like, you know, they've turned their phones back on and they're like got an extra phone one to be the fake, you know, maid service, all of this. Yeah, that's her doing.
And I like that we never see the daughter do it, though. Again, I like reading between the lines on this film.
Mad Max Fury Road. Like, you just pick it up as you go.
I don't know that that's my reference for ellipses, but yeah, okay. That's what we're watching.
Bong Joon-ho, that is his reference.
I think of that movie as more adrenaline and action and incredible stunt work in the desert, but this movie has its own kind of tension. And it is funny, but you do realize, as you always do when you're watching a satire, that these people were going to get caught. What is it going to look like? I think I could have predicted the trajectory of this first hour of the movie. Con artists take advantage of naive rich people, and then they get exposed and it all goes to hell. Like that, they kill each other, right? The surprise is the way that they deal with this maid.
I thought the story, the way it was going to go, because there's no way you could guess where this movie is going to go, but I figured, oh, they're going to eventually just replace this rich family. Like, they're going to con their way in there and just eventually take over their lives, and I don't know if they're going to kill them, how dark it's going to go, but I thought that was the movie.
Yeah.
With a title like Parasite, that's exactly what you'd expect, right? I mean, the parasite feeds off the host, and depending on the parasite, eventually kills.
Yeah, when they actually are saying, you know, it's call this exclusive maid service, and in order for you to deal with us, we need, like, the deed and, like, all your credit cards. Like, you really do feel like this rich family is going to be bled dry, and they'll be the ones poor. You think it's going to be a reversal in that way. I had a lot of things in my head at this point. I was really enjoying the movie, first time watching it. I had a lot of things in my head, but I thought I knew pretty much how this was going to wind up, and the joy of Parasite really is in its second. An hour where it really blows away all the presumptions of the trading places kind of scenario and goes in wildly new ways.
It is funny when the Parks go on the camping trip for the boy's birthday, and the Kims immediately make themselves so at home and making messes and just sitting around the table. But I think it's Kevin's delusions of I could marry this daughter. This house could be ours. And, you know, the mother starts laughing. You mean I'm cooking for my daughter-in-law and all of this? That really drives home how deluded they are at this moment. They have won their con so well that now they're fantasizing about something that could never happen because it would involve revealing themselves.
Well, I think there's a lot of tension here that plays into the themes later on. Again, the poor turning against themselves and, like, doing as much harm to themselves as the rich may do, because there's this whole line, like, he's like, oh, this is just a fantasy, but what if I married her and I'd have to hire fake parents? And, like, you can see the mom is not happy about that. Like, I'm gonna have to be the maid forever here. Like, you're gonna get fake parents to replace us because you can't reveal the truth.
Not only that, but Jessica has actually done that for money.
Yes.
Like, she's gone and caught bouquets because whatever. Again, this is just, yeah, the jokes that are flying around here are amusing. But it also is worth pointing out that Little Day Song has figured them out. Like, it takes the child, right, to call it out that the emperor has no clothes.
Or the emperor smells the same as all the other emperors.
Yes, exactly. They all have this scent on them. And I feel like Jessica and the chauffeur and the housemaid are all the same plot. I can just sense it with my nasal passages. That was a nice bit of tension, too, that it could be the act of a child that brings this whole house of cards down.
Well, and just the idea of their scent, like, there is something so classist about that. Like, you smell poor. And that's going to be a big deal when we get to the climax.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, they're talking, do we need to use different soaps? Do we need to use different detergents? Without realizing they need to live someplace different. They need to not take the subway.
Right. And I guess that this movie happens, and it's hard to know exactly how much time passes, but I feel like it's in too short a time for them to have saved money to go and do anything. Yeah, they've turned their phones back on, but they haven't made the real money yet. They're thinking about making money. They're planning about combining their resources and doing something with it. But I'm guessing a matter of weeks is all that we're watching.
Yeah, I don't know how much time has passed since they all conned their way to working in this house, but at this point, once that old maid shows up, it's what, 2 days? It's like that night and the next day is that party, so it's going to move very quickly from here.
So yes, everything is about Day Song and his birthday. We'll find out that he had a very traumatic birthday where he thought he saw a ghost, and now they're trying to humor him with this whole Cub Scout American Indian camping trip that will go kaflooey because, of course, it's crazy raining. But yeah, they head out of the picture, and the Kims think that they now own the house. This is where they're getting drunk. Part of the reason why they're thinking is blunted, Arnie, of course, is the fact that they are intoxicated. Like, if they were sober, maybe they would realize that they're not going to achieve all of these aims. But they're definitely talking like they could.
Even the maid, when she finally gets in that house, is going to go, this is all you could do is just drink their alcohol? Like, that's all your ambition is?
And read their diaries. I think there's, again, you say that Kevin is the most moral, but I don't know. Particularly if you take the stance that he's gay. The fact that he's reading a teenage girl's diary so he knows how to play lover to her so he can marry into the family is gross.
Yeah, but I mean, you're really seeing this gay subtext that I don't see. I think he really likes her.
I don't see the gay subtext, but I do see him. Yeah, he reads that diary so he could play her in the family.
He's not into her.
I think he is, the way that first kiss happens.
No, Arnie, he is not into her. There's no way that he's into her.
I think he's as into her as Mr. Park is into Mrs. Park. Like, it feels like that kind of eventual relationship. He wants to marry her to get this nice house.
Status. Again, I think that's a very good comparison. That's probably why the Parks ended up together. It's not love that brings them together. We're at the 1 hour mark, and yeah, we're thinking about how these two families are going to go at each other, and ding dong, the woman that we never thought would roll back into the picture has got like a black eye, and she's grinning really manically and talking about leaving something in the basement, and suddenly secret passages are being open, and you're like, what the fuck is this movie doing now? And I gotta say, I just jaw dropped when we find out there's a secret compartment to the house where she's keeping her husband.
I wasn't shocked that the housekeeper came back, because the way that they talked about her, how she seemed to think she was the one running the household, I could feel like she would be the one trying to undermine them and maybe even discovering them. But why? The fact that she says she left something in the basement, and it's not a plot to undermine the current housekeeper so much as it is her husband is down there starving to death. And somebody just accidentally or whatever wedged something underneath the moving bookcase so that that's why the husband couldn't come up for food.
Yeah, I think they say that it was part of the grill. And I don't know if that was something I missed that was going on in the background. But three viewings of this movie, I've never understood that that was anyone's intentional plot or a reason for it. It was just happenstance that this man almost starved to death. And now what are we going to do with the idea that there's another parasite leeching off the Parks? She wants to make a deal. I think it's kind of sweet that she's just thinking, oh, I don't care that you took my job. Can I pay you a little bit each month and you'll just keep my husband in hiding, because the loan sharks still want to kill him. We ran a bakery and we got into debt, and now if he steps outside, he's a dead man.
Mr. Kim mentioned something about a cake job earlier too. I was wondering, like, did they work together? Because yeah, it was weird that it's a bakery that comes up later.
She's so elaborate and ornate with her fruit platters and all of that. But I looked up what a Castella shop is, and that is kind of what they sell. It's like a cake and coffee and fruit plates. And they had their own business. They were thriving in the old generation. They were doing well. They didn't apparently have children. And now, yeah, they've had to been reduced to live like this.
They at least hint towards this, because when Mr. Park is talking to Mr. Kim in the car, Mr. Park's going, oh, she's a great housekeeper, but she eats for two people. She eats yes. so much. And now you realize why she's eating for two people. In the basement, she's going to be like, oh, I bought my own food. But because we heard these, she eats like for two people. We know she's been sneaking food down there the whole time. The shocker is that Mr. Park keeps close track of the groceries.
Well, and then, again, that makes you later we'll have the madam talk about, oh, the money's pretty good right now. Like, maybe these rich people aren't doing as well as we think they are. Maybe they're also trapped in their own shell game with creditors and people that are coming at them. Like, I feel like nobody is so rich that they don't have concerns about money.
The interesting thing with this maid's husband, and this is where I'm trying to read into, like, what are they getting at? Like, he has this infatuation with Mr. Park. Like, he is, like, giving him Morse code about how respect!
Respect!
Yeah.
We thought those lights were automated, but in fact, he's, like, headbutting them yeah. every time the man comes home.
Well, I think he just does that when he's tied up. Usually, he's just pushing it with his finger, but there is this idea, again, like, oh, we just got to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Like, let's just emulate the rich, and we could be like them, and that's not how it works. I get that vibe from this maid's husband. Like, if I just work hard enough, I could be just like Mr. Park. Like, that is the ideal.
I take this as a, you know, like the son is wont to say, it's so metaphorical, but I take it to mean that this house is Korea.
Yeah.
And that this was the old generation. The old generation showed deference, and the relationship between master and servant was more respectful. I take it to mean this man really is grateful that he's been given what he's been given to live. And yeah, this new generation has come into this house. You can tell the maid's not happy about it. She knew the original designer. She appreciated it as a space that didn't have all that junk that all the kids bring in with their technology and all of that. The fact that they have this moment now, when she turns the tables, realizes that the Kims are conning the Parks, like, she takes the video and now she wants to go and run the house. You know, we have that flashback about when she and the husband were living there before the Parks moved in. I think that they represent, a certain attitude about the working class that changed when the rich changed to the nouveau riche.
Yeah, I'll put it this way for understanding from a Western point of view. Like, growing up, my dad, okay, boomer, like, he would tell me, you know what, just offer to go work for a company for free for, like, a week to prove yourself that you're a good worker.
Mm.
I'm like, why would I work for free? I'm not going to sell my labor for free. That's ridiculous. Like, that is so foreign now to millennials and Gen Z. But my dad, that was totally normal. Like, yeah, give free labor, like, do whatever the boss says. And we were never a rich family. Like, he was not a rich man with that attitude, but that was his attitude.
Not only that, but like that generation, I think about both my parents working at the same place for 20, 30 years.
Forever.
Yeah, you know, like that generation believed you dedicated your life to something and that was what you did. And I definitely feel like all of that has changed and that the Kims represent the more gig economy, as you talked about.
But yeah, when you find this guy down there, it's still comedic. The way he acts, the fact that he's just so manic, the fact that she's begging, just feed him every couple days. Oh, once a week. You can just feed him once a week. And then, like a Three Stooges sketch, the rest of the family falls down the stairs because they were all fighting to overhear what was going on.
Yeah, this is where I feel like, look, I understand South and North Korea, but, like, is there more subtext that Koreans are going to pick up? Because they're going to start talking about North Korea and how the maid's going to get this picture of the whole family proving their cons, this video of them, and is like, this is the nuclear button that I could push and send it to the Parks, and it's all over.
You know, maybe a smarter scholar can work out the parallels between why Korea is split and the fact that this house is divided. But I think that Kim Jong-il joke is just that. It's just her deciding to be a ruthless, turn the tables on you. I'm going to punish you Kim Jong-il style now that I got you on video. Because with one send button, I can ruin your lives. I can expose this mirage that you were all separate people that referenced each other when in fact, you're a con artist, poor family.
Well, and just reading into, again, the class politics, these are both families that are in need, the maid's family and the Kims, and they're not helping each other. Like, they just want to exploit each other, too. Like, they have learned nothing. They're following the rich's example.
The woman was willing to work with them. Moon Guk was willing to say, just, you know, keep my husband down here and I'll pay you a little bit of money. And it was the new maid that was like, nope, I'm calling the police.
No, she wasn't willing to work with them once she discovered they were a whole family.
Well, no, yes, of course. Then she realized she had the upper hand. But up to that point, it's worth pointing out, she thought that this is a workable solution and that a fellow maid would take sympathy and take a little scratch money on the side.
And what's interesting, when I was watching this with my daughters, like, they always like to pick their favorite characters when they're watching a movie. And my older daughter, like, they both love this family, but my older daughter, this is where she turns against the Kims. Like, she's like, why didn't they just help them? Like, they're being jerks too.
Oh, they're total jerks. Again, I don't think you should watch this movie and think that we're rooting for them. I mean, it's hard not to on a certain level because we were introduced to their plight and their poverty. But yeah, they're pretty awful people. Like, what they're doing is not justifiable by the fact that the rich people are also awful.
That's why I think that the director has done a great job of playing us. These made these bad people sympathetic. And so because we started off on their side, as they're going to do worse and worse things, we still stay on their side. He's playing us.
Yeah, I agree. It's an expertly calibrated script that has been expertly directed by the same individual. And again, and an individual who hadn't shown that level of maturity and understanding of human psychology in the films I had seen. So again, this is all a marvelous surprise. Can he keep it going? We now see a fight for the phone, like Kims versus Gooks, as they realize that the phone holds their future in hand. And ring, 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 the landline lets them know that the Parks are coming home. The rain is bringing home the birthday party.
Yeah, they're 8 minutes away and they want a full cooked meal when they walk in.
Ramdon, whatever the hell that is. This woman not only has to learn a meal.
I don't know, that meat looked good.
But she has to, like, kick a bitch down the staircase and, like, hide all the booze. She's drunk while she's doing all of this. Props to her. She probably deserves the job if she weren't so corrupted.
She's Googling the recipe. It's something with ramen.
And it is brutal when she kicks the maid down the stairs, the old maid, and like the sound design for that head crunching against that wall. It's hard to listen to.
And of course, what's the punchline when they walk in? The child doesn't want no damn noodles. It's like 3 a.m. Like, no. And the woman that requested it and said it has to be ready eats it even though she doesn't want it. Because it has sirloin steak. We can't let it go to waste. Which again, lets you know that there is a penny-pinching awareness that is happening with this family, even though they present as having luxury and opulence.
The rich don't get rich by wasting money.
Well, I mean, the truly rich can throw out some ramdon, you know what I mean? Like, they could let that go. They don't have to eat it, but it is a character-defining detail that the wife decides to eat it.
So, do you go with this, what I consider to be the biggest stretch of the movie, is that the Parks are home, there's been food spilled all over the carpet, drinks, there's people hiding under a table, and they are completely oblivious to it all. This is the one point where I feel like the movie goes into weird science territory and may be a little bit too much. It's going into almost slapstick comedy and losing a sense of reality.
It's a metaphor about how they don't see the four, but no, I kind of agree with you, Arnie. Like, this is the part, like, yeah, hiding under a table, like, we're just gonna push all our crumbs and broken bottles, like, under this table, and it's not gonna go noticed? Maybe, I don't know. They never really turn those lights on, I guess.
I think it's very satisfying because of what it reveals. Like, we have the Kims hiding under the coffee table, having it confirmed what the rich really think about them while still engaging in, you know, poor man sex. Like, you know, the fact that, like, they want to pretend they're in the back seat of the car now and he's not having sex with her. I mean, he's fingering her, but he's not penetrating her. Again, it says a lot about what turns them on and the fact that the rich, for all of their need to separate from the poor class, has a fascination with being street.
I love him telling his wife, put on those panties you found. That is the, like, grossest thought.
Yeah, right.
Find some strange panties and just wear them.
Mm-hmm. And she did, like, inspect, like, when she inspected them, she broke out, like, the plastic gloves and was, like, going through it. So it was, again, there is a fetish, I think, that they're implying that the rich, there's something about being dirty and poor that fascinates them. That it would be freeing, maybe, to not live such a sterile life that they're living.
But this is where you get a lot of stuff about Mr. Park bringing up that smell, and he doesn't like the smell of Mr. Kim. And Mr. Kim's got to hear all this. It's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. It's a performance thing. The guy that's playing the father, Kim, is this it's a largely internal part. He's largely been a goofball, but in this moment, he's heartbreaking having to process self-loathing, essentially, is what we're talking about here. Like, he knows he smells. He wishes he didn't live in that basement apartment. And lo and behold, once he gets out of here, those torrential rains make sure that he will never again.
Yeah, this scene is so disgusting. Like, raw sewage flooding their basement apartment, that toilet spewing shit. And the irony that Mrs. Kim is like, oh, this rain is so great. And then you see how the Parks are dealing with it. Again, it's such a great way to demonstrate, like, the difference between rich and poor. Like, this thing, like, oh, just rain, like, not a big deal. But for poor people, when you live underground in subpar housing, like, it's awful.
Yeah, well, the rich, they had to cancel their birthday party camping trip. Like, that to them was the hardness. And now their son wants to sleep outside in the teepee. And, well, now we have to sleep in the living room. Yeah, that's the hardships that the rich are experiencing. Meanwhile, people are losing their home. Meanwhile, people are being kicked downstairs and getting concussions and dying.
Was the, I'm assuming, homeless guy that's always peeing next to the Kim's apartment, like, was that foreshadowing, like, raw sewage coming in as urine, and now it's, like, actual raw sewage?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, again, they made such a point about should we keep the window open or not, and the idea was that keeping it open was somehow to their benefit, but I don't know, even if they had closed it, that they would have been able to keep out all of this sewage.
That toilet is spewing shit out of it. It's getting flooded one way or another.
Yeah, it literally is firing at them like a water cannon of poop.
I don't know why Jessica just sits there smoking. I guess, what can you do at that point?
You know, it's a way of coping. It is why people smoke, right? It helps them process.
But as the Kims, at least the three of them, the mom still has to pretend to be maid and stay with the Parks, but the rest of the Kims have to go to a shelter, and this is where you get a big scene between the father and son talking about plans, and the father kind of admits, like, yeah, I never really believed in the plan.
never really believed, or maybe lamenting that he did believe. I took it to mean that he wishes that he hadn't dreamed, that it's painful to have ambitions that go unrealized. I didn't know that he was saying, I never followed a plan. I think he always wanted out of that basement, and I think he was hoping his kids would lift them up.
Yeah, it's such a metaphorical moment to see them wallowing in literal shit while everything's kind of falling apart back out that house.
Yeah, and Kevin's still carrying that scholar stone around. He saved that from the apartment.
Yeah, it's interesting that he grabbed that. And what does that mean for him? Like, I don't understand. Does anyone understand what it is? Like, I've never seen anyone that collected this. They're not geodes. They're like...
No, this is a thing, I guess, in Korea started, you know, centuries ago. Like, the monks would find them in rivers, and that's why they were called scholar stones, because they were considered, you know, monks are smart, I guess. And so if you wanted to be like that, you'd have these stones that could bring, yeah, different fortune. The actor, because Bong Joon-ho really didn't want to talk about, like, why he had this scholar stone in here, except that it's metaphorical. But Kevin, the actor, said to him it was about Sisyphus. Like, that stone that you're pushing up all day, and then it just rolls down, and you got to start over again.
And of course, it is a weapon that will be used against him. He thinks it's going to bring good luck, and it will be brutally thrown down on his head a couple times once we get into this climax, which is all centered around Jae Sung's birthday. Like, it's, you know, we gotta, like, have an impromptu celebration. I'll pay you double, so that should make it all right, and we'll get you out, you know, out shopping so we can throw this elaborate party for our friends.
Only now does Mrs. Park realize Mr. Kim's smell. After her husband talked about it, now she can barely stand to be driven around by him. Of course, he was waiting and shit.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. They got to put on this facade, even though they're dealing with this awful thing back home, losing their home probably, like losing everything, really. And they still got to put on this smile and play these roles. Again, another heartbreaking moment with Mr. Kim is when Mr. Park is telling him, okay, we're going to do this whole thing with my son, and we're going to pretend to be Native Americans and pop out. And Mr. Kim is not into this. And Mr. Park's like, I'm paying you for this. Deal with it. Like, ugh, the expectations Mr. Park has. Like, if I give you money, you just do whatever I say.
Yeah, and at the same time, Kim is like, well, why are you doing it, though? I guess you love your wife. Like, he kept coming back to that as some kind of, there must be love here, which we know is not true. And I think it's painful for Mr. Park to realize that he is going along with his wife's silly little plans, that he is wearing this headdress.
Yeah, and that's when he says, I'm paying you for this. Like, he is offended that he's brought up the idea of love.
Right, and he shouldn't have to justify himself to the help. I mean, I think you see that tension too. But one thing I'm curious about, I couldn't figure out in all my viewings of this, that in the middle of the night, we saw Dae-sung go out to the teepee. He's not asleep. He's watching the light fixture blink. We do know that the gook husband is downstairs sending a message, and that his wife is dead at this point. Does the son know what's about to happen? I couldn't tell that he did.
No, because when this guy comes up, we realize that's the ghost. That's the ghost he thought he saw when he was eating his cake those years ago, and he had a big seizure. And so when the guy comes back up again, the boy has another seizure. And I thought, like, maybe Mrs. Park was being dramatic. Like, oh my god, he had a seizure, and we had to take him to the ER, and he was foaming at the mouth. I'm like, he was eating white frosting. Is that the foaming at the mouth? But no, we see him. He really does fall down and foam at the mouth and start spasming when this guy comes out. It's the ghost from years ago.
Right. So the kid doesn't really, he didn't really learn anything by translating that Morse code. That's just to tell us that that's a communication device that will be used later.
Yeah, and I think it does build some tension, because is this kid going to reveal everything now? Things are going to go way crazy before that ever happens, but this kid has always been onto them. He's been communicating with the former May, telling her all about this family. He's deciphering the Morse code.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you feel like he's going to be the one to pull back the curtain and expose it all. But really, it's worth pointing out that the Kims are concerned. They do want to make sure that both the gooks are alive and healthy, and they're trying to get plates of food down to them. But the one that ends up going down there is Kevin, and he really does suffer some terrible blows to the head for his trouble.
I am shocked he's alive at the end of this film. Like,
agreed.
He gets hit once, and then they're going to show Mr. Gook drop that stone on his head again. And again, the sound design and just, it's the puddle of blood there. It's hard to watch.
Oh, it is. And I thought he was dead too. And that, you know, having watched this a couple years ago, I did not remember such a dramatic ending as killing him. But I thought for sure he was dead.
You wouldn't have predicted, well, there's a lot about this movie you wouldn't predict, but you wouldn't predict the epilogue that happens after this bloody climax. I knew it would end in blood. It feels like that's a pretty big theme in a lot of Korean movies like this that center on class, that you end up breaking out knives. But how it all goes and who lives and who dies and why is a real surprise.
This ending goes way crazy. I wouldn't have predicted the basement or anything like that going on, but this does feel very Korean. Like, again, a lot of the Korean films I watch, they just have these moments of extreme violence. If you watch Oldboy, I feel like that's why people love Oldboy.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yes, that movie mixes like slapstick comedy and shocking violence and melodramatic plot twists related to families. Again, but not as successfully. I just want to call out that this movie, for all of its outlandishness, still for me remains centered on something that feels very true and hard to shake. And even though I would dare say it's not a drama, it has the weight of one, certainly when we're getting these moments of violence.
This ending doesn't feel out of place. That's how I'll put it. It is crazy and chaotic and violent and bloody. It doesn't feel out of place. Like, I feel like we got here through a natural route. It wasn't forced.
It's over the top, but yet matches the reality that this movie has created.
So what goes down? Well, Jessica, who was supposed to pretend to be attacked by Indians with tomahawks, actually does get stabbed and pretty much dies right here on the lawn. And as you say, Arnie, the child that saw a ghost what he saw was Mr. Gook come out to get food on a midnight food raid so many years ago, sees him again, has the same seizure, and now, of course, the parks think they only have 15 minutes to save his life. They're demanding that their chauffeur take care of that child over taking care of what they couldn't know is his daughter.
They don't know it's his daughter. That's what's so heartbreaking. It's like Mr. Kim is like, there's no way I'm leaving her. Like, this is my daughter. But I guess Mr. Park can't know that. But, you know, he could control his reaction to the smell. Like, he'll go to get those keys. They've fallen under Mr. Gook, who's been stabbed by a kebab from Mrs. Kim. And, like, he's got to hold that nose as he gets it. And that's what makes Mr. Kim cross the line.
I love, though, stabbed with a kebab. And Mr. Gook is still yelling, respect, Mr. Yes. Park. I mean, that is, I don't know why he's screaming in English, but it just really makes me laugh.
It was sincere to me that he really did appreciate. He was old school. You know, you just worked for the same boss and you appreciated the boss, and the boss was God. And even in this dying moment here, like, his beef wasn't with this family. It was with the woman that kicked his wife down the stairs and who has, yes, felled him with shish kebab.
I love later on we'll see the dog eating the meat off that shish kebab still in the side of Mr. Park.
Yeah, so many little details you don't get on a first or even second viewing that I'm picking up watching it now. It's a movie with many layers.
It's also a movie with many endings. I feel like there's four endings to this film. I mean, the movie could have just ended here, right? Mr. Kim walks away. You could have just left it as this down ending.
You could have, and I think in a first viewing, that's probably where you wanted to leave it because that was all you could process. But I really do appreciate that we have the extra 18 minutes, I think it is, here at the end, that after Mr. Kim just loses it, you know, just takes the knife. He's the one that kills Mr. Park. He's the one that, like, ends up, like, for the little guy, like, had enough, like, taking out the man and then running away and disappearing seemingly in thin air. When the news crews show up, they check the CCTV footage of all the streets.
Which doesn't exist because the former maid cut the wires.
That's true.
Only on one of them, but he wasn't on the other cameras.
Right. Yeah, they don't know where he went, and so he seemingly vanished. Like a ghost. And Kevin, yes, does somehow recover from that head wound. Am I right on this? Is that the chauffeur now as cop interviewing him?
I did not catch that, if that was the case.
I thought that was June. The reason why he was laughing was that June ended up getting... The reason why he was not a good detective was he was the former chauffeur trying to make a new career go.
I don't know. I thought Kevin was just turning into the Joker. He got some head injury and just laughs uncontrollably all the time now.
Oh, he does. I mean, he goes to a museum and is laughing. He eventually, I guess, gets over it. But when he wakes up from that surgery, he just can't stop inappropriate laughter.
That's not a museum. That's like a mausoleum. Like, that's where they have the ashes of his sister.
Oh, well, that makes much more sense for him to go to.
Yeah, the mom is crying because they're looking at an urn with the daughter in it, and he's laughing. But yeah, it's got a kind of Clockwork Orange feel to it, and certainly in the way that it's come full circle and feels crazy. And yes, when you realize that basically Mr. Kim has traded places with Mr. Gook, and now he is in that basement. They only had one moment together in the middle of that crazy night. He kind of judged Gook for settling. You know, he was like, why did you stay here? Like, why would you be content to just move into some secret room of a house and never have any ambition to leave? And now that is his fate.
It makes me think, you know, he's in a prison of his own choosing. He could just be in a prison. He doesn't have to be in that prison.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. He could walk out at any time. And presumably, at some point, I know a new German family moves in, but they probably go on vacations. He probably could slip out and return to his family.
Yeah, except there's a new maid that's always around, making it hard for him to get food.
Possibly, but I also just think maybe there's something in the idea that I don't know what else to do. Like, I don't know how to go on with a plan. I don't know how to get out of the basement level. I give up.
Any idea if, like, there was a reason it was Germans that moved in? Again, I'm not a Korean historian, so I don't know everything that's gone on. I was wondering if there was something to Germans moving in. They didn't say anything in the extras that I watched.
Yeah, a curiosity that I would want the director to speak to.
I took it as because they were just foreigners. They didn't know about the house. But yeah, there could be subtext I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It feels like every decision here is metaphorical, is done with purpose. So why Germans and not Belgians or any other ethnic group? Who can say?
How much reality is there to this ending? Because I feel like Mr. Kim, he's going to do the Morse code thing. It's a very long Morse code message. It's like a full letter. I don't know how realistic that is and for Kevin to figure it out.
When you have nothing else to do, you are in a basement 24/7. You can write a lot of Morse code and just sit there and tap it out.
Yeah, but like Kevin, I don't know. I guess he stayed there a while and watched the whole thing. Hopefully he didn't walk in during the middle of it and have to wait for it to start over again.
Come back the next night.
I mean, we get so much about Kevin always being this one that comes up with these plans, and this whole ending is about his plan to buy the house. I just wonder if this whole Morse code thing is just in his head as he's trying to come up with a plan, that he's come up with this idea that his dad's still there.
His brain-damaged head, too, is worth pointing out. His thinking is blunted now, so yes, I definitely think you're free to interpret this all as madness. It certainly is a crazy idea that he thinks he can come up with enough money to buy this house one day, and that's how he'll save his dad.
Though it's weird, we see him return that scholar stone to the river, which feels like, let's put things back in their natural order, but then he still has this crazy plan. Like, look, I got a pretty good job, but I live in LA. There's no way I'm ever going to afford a house. I don't know how Kevin's going to buy that house in South Korea.
No, not going to happen, which of course is the tragedy of it all, that even though he's imagining the sunny day in which he can walk through as rightful owner into that establishment, he's still sitting in that basement apartment. They cleaned it out. He and his mom are still living. Hopefully at least the stink bugs are dead. I'd like to believe at least the stink bugs are gone from their life.
But the stink isn't. The stink's probably actually worse now.
Agreed. And so they end on that, on those words, so long, you know, which is goodbye and how long it will take, you know, forever for him to achieve that reunion with his dad.
So Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Parasite? Jacob.
You know, it's always great to watch a movie where, especially at our age, like we know how plots go. We know how to look for all the clues. So to be genuinely surprised by where a movie goes is a very rare event these days, and I love it. The shock to me the first time I watched this, once that basement door opens up and you find there's a whole other level to this movie, literally, like, it blew my mind. For a movie that I was already really into and enjoying, like, it just took it deeper. And the fact that it's Bong Joon-ho, whose films I'm pretty familiar with, where, again, Snowpiercer, I know that's a big cult hit. I think it's kind of overrated. And like, I have enjoyed all of his films, even Oakjaw to a certain extent. Like, I enjoyed, my girls hated that one, but like, it's kind of a crazy film. But to see him then do this, I was trying to think, like, has another director taken this leap? The only one I can think of is Adam McKay, who did like comedies like Anchorman, which I detest. And then he starts doing things like The Big Short and Vice and, well, Don't Look Up kind of feels like a throwback to his older comedies, but like all of a sudden he's getting Academy Award nominations and like is a serious director. It's not something you usually see, like this turnaround. And so to see that with Bong Joon-ho, like all of a sudden do this very mature film, like I'm like, wow, he's gone into a whole different direction. I can't wait to see what he's doing. Like he went from doing things that I like to doing this film that I loved because of there's so much going on, like the writing, the editing, the cinematography, like everything is double best picture worthy for foreign and best picture. Like here, like everything is just at the top of its game. Like it's a great thriller with like, if you listen to this review, we spoil it all, but hopefully you watched it beforehand because the surprises are so fun in this one. Yeah. Strong recommend for Parasite.
Stuart.
I agree. I love to watch artists make that massive leap from going to like, here's where you thought I was and here's what I can do. And that's what Bong Joon-ho does in this movie. You watch any of his other ones and they're all pretty good, except Okja. I hated that film. But they all have the same themes. I mean, Snowpiercer is so much, maybe we'll cover that one day, but like it's so much about the same idea about class and what train car you belong into and all of that.
Even The Host, which is a monster movie, like has ideas of class in it.
Yeah. But they all have this sort of junky sheen to them. And I don't mean that to sound dismissive, but just that I thought of them in a certain way. They were good films. They weren't masterpieces. And then you watch this and you go, yeah, this is genius. This is a work of absolute marvelous, extraordinary attenuation to social satire. It gets to the universal while feeling very specific to the South Korean culture. Like, that's hard to do. It's hard to make something feel authentic to a time and place and at the same time connect to everyone in the world, which this film has done. Somehow it won the Cannes Film Festival, it won the Oscar, and it won the American box office. And again, I'm really interested in how this is going to be adapted into an HBO show. I don't know if you got details on that, but it feels like this is going to be the one that Bong Joon-ho is remembered for. And I remember him saying at the time, he didn't think that this was a commercial film. His commercial films are the goofy monster ones. And then this one was something eccentric and rare. And it is, but it also has something I think everyone will take from. And I highly, highly recommend it.
3 for 3 on very strong recommends, and I agree with everything you said, Jacob, about being surprised and twists and turns and jaw-dropping when you find out that Mr. Gook is living in the basement and everything. Just completely unpredictable. But what this movie does is also show that a bias that I hold isn't always true. Not all Oscar-nominated and winning films are stodgy, boring drama pieces. They can have some fun to them. They can have some life to them. I have to say, a lot of times, I watch Oscar-nominated, and the worst one for me in 2019 was Little Women. You know, when I watched all the Best Picture nominees, Little Women was hard. And this one was by far the best, you know, and it's because it had a sense of fun, it had a sense of humor, and it also had some crazy twists. It shows once in a while, Oscar still can get it right. Yeah, I love this movie, strong recommend. And a big thanks to Justin Ramsey for picking it and letting me watch it again.
And as far as the TV show, it's funny. I talked about Adam McKay being this director that I felt turn a corner. He is the one kind of in charge of the HBO TV series. And apparently they're working on the writing. It's not going to be a remake of Parasite. They're saying it's going to exist in the same world. Bong Joon-ho has mentioned, he's like, yeah, when that maid shows up all bruised, he's like, I know why. So maybe they'll explore some of those side stories that are hinted at in the film. But it's going to be in the same universe, but I don't know if it's going to be the same characters. It wasn't really clear. Sounds like they're working on the writing still.
So it could be with Koreans. It's not going to be Americanized.
They said the same universe, so it could be Americans in that Parasite universe.
Could be the Germans.
Yes, the
Germans.
We don't
know why they moved in.
Yeah, I know nothing about Korean film stars to know if the people in this movie are huge stars too big to come back for a TV series.
Oh, Mr. Kim is in all the Bong Joon-ho films. Like, he's always showing up as the main character.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes him a star, but he's recognizable to me. Well, I look forward to seeing that. HBO usually does do a good job with their TV series, and God knows I would like the spirit of this movie to continue. I would like more things to feel as epic as this. And what do we think? We're releasing the show today on the Oscars.
I don't like any of the films nominated.
Yeah, I don't think any of them are, unfortunately, Parasite.
Yeah, Licorice Pizza, I like that one. I'm a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, but yeah, none of them excite me that much.
Yeah, kind of an off year. But my guess, just going to go out there and predict Power of the Dog, going to get the big ones.
Awful, awful. I don't dislike it for the same reasons as Sam Elliott, but I did not like that movie.
I think the only thing that could hurt Power of the Dog, which is my guess as well, is if people hadn't cast their votes before she made that guffaw at the Critics' Choice Awards and insulted the Williams sisters. That could quickly get her canceled. My thought would be, you know, I'm kind of ambivalent. All I can tell you is Dune won't win.
No. And look, Benedict Cumberbatch, no more playing an American until you learn how to do an American accent. That was so distracting in Power of the Dog. Like, that guy cannot be an American.
He's not going to win. It's Will Smith's week year, and I want Will Smith to win for that movie. He was really good.
So, once again, thank you to all of our patrons for supporting our show and joining us for Parasite on this Oscar Sunday. And we have, of course, another show coming up for you next month.
After we learn the secrets of Dumbledore and finish off the Platinum Level series, we're going to find out the secret life of Walter Mitty and the secret life of Ben Stiller as a movie director, because he actually remade that film.
I didn't realize he directed that. I've been watching Severance on Apple TV, which he's directing.
Yeah, I think he's an underrated behind-the-camera guy. Because his comedies have been so big, we forget that I have a soft spot for the cable guy. Sorry, it's true.
Oh, yeah, underrated for sure.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm curious to know how he's going to handle Don Knotts' material and make it fresh. We'll find out. It's a patron request we'll cover for April patrons, just a few weeks.
So, Stuart, Jacob, thank you for joining me, and until next time, so long.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast. And a special thanks to Justin Ramsey for his incredible support of our show and for picking Parasite for our hosts to review.
Respect!
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated. Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.